Gamma ray bursts. So this is work I did with Eric Blackman and Vladimir Usov. So what we have? We have 2,704 bats of gamma ray bursts, very evenly distributed, as you probably all well know. So what we're trying to explain? Four basic points. First, we need isotropic energy in gamma ray photons of 10 to the 51, 10 to the 53 Earths. Time scale from milliseconds to hundreds of seconds. And emission should peak about 500 keV with a long power, low tail, strongly non-thermal. And of course, the afterglows, X-ray, optical, and radio afterglows. So, example of GRB spectra with a nice power loss. Okay. There are several problems that you run immediately into if you try to solve the problem head on. First, if you put this amount of energy, 10 to the 51, 10 to the 53 ergs, in leptons or photons, then the plasma becomes immediately optically thick to gamma-gamma pair production. And the typical optical thickness, without taking any relativistic effects, would be this compactness parameter, which is L over L Eddington gravitational radius over R. So if your radius is of the given by the smallest variability scale, that gives you the optical thickness of 10 to the 13. So, if you become optically thick, first you degrade radiation to at least 500 keV, the electron rest mass. Secondly, what you will see is a thermal spectrum. The diffusion times will be very long. And even a small contamination of with baryons of order 10 to the minus 6 of the solar will put all the energy into expansion instead of the radiation. So these are the problems that all the gamma ray bursts should address, gamma ray burst theories should address. So currently there is, well, since there are no real advocates of this internal shock wave model, I can criticize it here openly. Okay. So the current most popular is internal shockwaves model, and the answer to the most problems comes from this scaling of the optical depths, meaning if you have a strongly relativistic plasma, it scales something like tau, non-relativistic over gamma to the sixth. So to get from 10 to the 13 to approximately 1, you need gamma factors of from 100 to 1,000. So, in this model, there is a long-lived source which generates strongly non-stationary flow. And as this non-stationary flow heats on itself, you generate internal shocks. Then you assume that there is some acceleration of electrons at the internal shocks. And you also need also to generate magnetic fields in those internal shocks. And in the end, you produce radiation. Critique. This model has no predictable prediction. All the energy scales and all the time scales are totally arbitrary. For example, the typical frequency of emitted photons is something like gamma minimum, gamma bulk, omega b. All these factors are arbitrary in this model. And another thing, the typical break frequency for the gamma ray burst usually falls in a pretty narrow range between maybe 200 keV and 500 keV. And you have the scaling of something like gamma cube and omega b, so it is hard to see how can you very different sources in the different parts of the universe with such strong dependence on the parameters produce very narrow dispersion in the peak frequencies.
But what do these parameters mean?
Gamma minimum is the lower cutoff in the spectra of synchrotron emitting electrons. So usually it's power law, and then you have a freedom of the lower cutoff. And you adjust it so that your frequency would fall. Well, in this model, you adjust the gamma minimum to so that the peak frequency would fall into the desired range. And also, this model has a very low efficiency of radiation, because in a collision of internal shocks, you dissipate the relative energy, the energy of the relative motion between the shocks, which is something like 1 over gamma of the total energy. And there are actually some fundamental questions whether the collisionless shock may exist without magnetic field at all. So,
what determines the relative energy? Why is it 1 over gamma at the
total? Well, it comes from something like relativistic transformations. So if you have in relativism, the gamma factors multiply when you go from one frame to another. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have...
The internal shocks are mildly relativistic.
Yeah, they're mildly relativistic, so...
So in the rest frame there, frame more than one. So they're all moving roughly at the same speed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So there are many internal shocks.
Yes, there are many internal shocks. Because sometimes you see maybe 10,000 spikes in one burst. Okay. So you need 10,000 collisions, but these are collisions that the fast overtaking the slow ones, so you don't. So you need at least something like 1,000 or 10,000.
So they're presumably all spherical. Faster and slower.
That's right. Well, spherical, not necessarily. You may still have shocks in a kind of directed outflow, but yeah. So the alternative to this, as I see, is pointing flux-driven outflows. And the basic ingredients of the model is that if you can generate a very strong magnetic field, something like 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 Gauss, and you assume that your engine is related to something like a stellar mass progenitor, then which is rotating fast. The stellar mass is critical. Frequency will be something like 10 to the 4 radians per second, and radii of the order of 10 to the 6 centimeters. So if you assume that something generates this kind of system in the center, then the typical dipole spin-down luminosity will be of the order of what you need to account for the energetics.
You are saying stellar mass progenitor, but kind of a neutron star.
Yeah, well, so that the gravitational radius is of the order of 10 to the 6 centimeters, and the frequency of the last stable orbit is something like 10 to the 4 radians per second.
And this will be in a rarefied medium. But in your case, you have very dense plasma, so which surrounds this progenitor.
We'll get to that. You're right, absolutely. So, the basic ideas that I'm going to discuss is that starting with this ansatz, magnetic field will be able to first more or less quietly transport energy from the central engine. It will be able to convert efficiency into radiation, and it may help us generate afterglows. Maybe a little bit more on the advantages of the this magnetized model. First, you may you wouldn't care about mass loading, because as we know, say, in pulsars, actually a lot of what I will be talking about will be related to the part of physics that we understand in pulsars. Well, for example, in pulsars, you may not generate any ions. The flow may be totally electron-positron dominated. Then compactness problem. You don't have to thermalize collimation. You naturally have, since you chose the rotator, you naturally have two preferred directions. First the jet, and then the equatorial outflows. And then magnetic field is a low entropy state, so to say, so it's easy to convert into radiation. And there are internal instabilities. And what is important, in this model that I will discuss, the energy, that the typical energy of emission will be related to the Compton energy. So just fundamental combination of fundamental constants. So three stages. So first you generate the strongly magnetized relativistic outflow, then you produce a burst, and then you produce afterglow. The generation. There are several ideas how you can generate this kind of parameters. First is the accretion-induced collapse of a magnetized white dwarf. And then you can also generate a lot of magnetic field due to the dynamo action in a relativistic turbulence, which can be driven either by the neutrinos or by the turbulence in some kind of a disk which you form by whatever mean around your central engine. So this is the cartoon. Maybe I'm spending a bit too much on the cartoon of the model. So you have magnetic field, rotator, you generate MHD pointing dominated outflow, meaning that though you have a lot of plasma, but the energy is carried mostly by the magnetic field. Then at some radius, there is an internal instability of this outflow, which I will discuss, which generate the gamma ray burst. And then you hit the interstellar medium and generate afterglow. So first, a small sidetrack. What is the dominant pair producing effect near the source? First, the Compton cross section is strongly suppressed in super strong magnetic fields, and for the X mode, it is a square of the energy versus the cyclotron energy. And secondly, your flux in pairs is much less than your total energy flux. So this tau may not necessarily be of the much larger than unity. And secondly, there is a competing effect, like in pulsars, the pair production of gamma photons on a magnetic field. And again, you may argue that if this is more important, you will proceed more along the pulsar type pair generation, when the density of pairs that you generate, it will be related to the Goldratt-Julian density, which is given this. So you're faced with two possibilities. First, flow may not be optically thick near the center. And that turns out to be not very interesting, because if it's not optically amount of energy that you put into pairs is very small compared to the total energy, then optically, even if you're optically thin, you won't see anything. And again, for pulsars, this ratio is from 10 to the minus 2 to something like 10 to the minus 6. And again, we don't quite understand how to calculate it, so we may argue that in gamma ray bursts it may be of same range. So if it's 10 to the minus 6, you're optically thin. If it's 10 to the minus 2, you're still optically thick. But now we're not afraid of it, because, in a sense, because that tells you, now we're dealing with only maybe a hundredth of the total energy. The energy in the photons is only a hundredth of the total energy. And indeed, if the flow is optically thick, then we may say that we should observe something like a precursor to the main burst. And this is not a random burst, but it has this small precursor with the energy of something like 10 to the minus 2 of the total one. And there is a prediction that with that precursor should have a thermal spectrum, and what would be the typical energy of that thermal emission of the precursor? Usually, if you have a relativistic plasma, optically thick, and you would ask, what would be the typical temperature at the optical depth of the order of unity? And it turns out to be something like 5% of mc squared. But the first guess would be mc squared, but no, it's 5%, because at this energy, you still have a lot of high-energy photons that will pair-produce and make you optically thick. So something like 25 keV is the emission of a relativistic optically thick plasma. And then, since this front is moving relativistically due to the radiation pressure with the typical energies of gamma 50s, the observed temperature should be of the order of 1 MeV.
This 25 kV, is that the same kind of temperature you get for soft gamma repeater outbursts?
That's right. It should be the same. Well, on a sidetrack, Thomson has a very different model of it. He gets his 20 kV in a different way. And I think that since in gamma ray repeaters we have I think one is 20 and another is 30. And I think that it's also maybe this number, not... Thomson gets it from some mode conversion things.
Does this depend on the presence of magnetic field?
No, this is...
So this should be true for all bursts.
Well, magnetic field will modify this, but this is a rough estimate.
What would be the typical time of this, length of this precursor?
Yeah, it should be of the order of the rise time of the emission. So this is exactly how...
When you are saying it is optically thick, you can calculate, say, radiation diffusion time or something like that.
Yeah.
Is it consistent?
Yeah, it should be of the order of the time it takes the flow to propagate to the main burst, something like that.
The gamma is a bit, 50 is a bit low, so... at least an MeV.
Yeah.
But you know already that these precursors are in fact softer than the MeV.
No, we don't.
The giga precursors are softer.
Yeah. That's a good point, because what is usually people call a precursor is not what we call a precursor. Usually, the definition of a precursor is that intensity just drops to zero. This is a very different one. So
those precursors have nothing in common with your precursor.
That's right.
Can you explain those precursors too?
Well, those are they're more like just a part of the main gamma ray burst. Yeah.
I'm not sure. Confusing precursor. ROSAT people once in a while used to report a precursor.
That's right. So
those are 10 seconds sometimes.
Yeah. So the definition of the precursor that is most commonly used so far is that there is the flux drops to background in between something and something, and it is a little bit different what we call a precursor, and ours is should be no more than maybe a hundredth bright, and the typical length of that precursor should be of the order of the rise time of the main burst.
So it might be indistinguishable from the rise, it's just the initial part of the rise.
Yes, so far it is indistinguishable, and with GLAST we hope that it will be possible to distinguish them, because this one must have thermal spectrum. And that would be the key point, how you can distinguish just a part of the burst bit and the emission from this thermal photosphere.
With GLAST, so you want the thermal peak of about 100 MeV then?
Not 100, about 1 MeV.
Yeah, but GLAST won't have any sensitivity then. It drops off below 30 MeV dramatically. They won't see anything at 1 MeV unless they have... I mean, you're talking about the GLAST Montgomery burst monitor, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's only a small instrument. Compared with that.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, now back to the mainstream. So we generated this magnetized relativistic outflow. So how are we going to convert it into the radiation? And here I would rely on something like MHD breakdown. So first, we don't, since this model is mostly based on the pulsar physics, and there is a big pulsar question, is the structure of the outflow from the pulsars, and it's still not resolved, so we don't quite understand it. So there are different ideas how the relativistic MHD outflow should look like, and one of them, of which Andrew is one of the advocates, is that at some distance you cannot satisfy a condition for hydrodynamics. And the idea is the following, that in the induction equation you have two currents, conduction and displacement current. So if you have a relativistic plasma, then the maximum conduction current will be some, well, forgetting about 2 pi's, 2 times the density times C. And again, in a relativistic plasma, E is of the order of B, and time derivative will be of the order of omega. So that puts a condition on the density. So for the MHD approximation to be satisfied, your density should be larger than some critical density, which, interestingly enough, turns out to be Goldreich-Julian density. And this critical density falls as 1 over R, because our B is mostly toroidal, and it falls as 1 over R. The real density should be falling as 1 over R squared. So then there is a radius at which the real density becomes a critical density, which in our case is something like 10 to the 14 centimeters. And at that distance, for your reference, the typical density is 10 to the 8 centimeters per cube, and magnetic field 10 to the 6.
To estimate what is the density, you should know.
That's right. So
it's really close to the source curve.
That's right. And I took 10 to the 7 Goldreich-Julian. So this is for the normalization, 10 to the 7 of Goldreich-Julian at the source. And typically for pulses, we get from 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7. And the interesting point that nothing will depend on density. The typical energy won't depend neither on density nor on the magnetic field.
So you assume that the magnetic field at the source is constant.
Yes. Yes. And by the way, this would be a similar estimate. Well, yeah. So before this critical radius, you have a more or less a quiet MHD outflow. So when plasma could short out the displacement current. So now not suddenly, but the plasma cannot short out the displacement current. So instead of a MHD flow, the flow turns into a strong electromagnetic wave type flow. Because, you know, usually it's in a wave you have strong displacement currents. And this wave is very strong. It's so strong. So the typical strength parameter is something like 10 to the 9. And that's more or less the momentum of a particle in terms of MC in a wave. It's very big. And near the equatorial plane, this wave should look like a linearly polarized wave, while near the polar region it would look like a circularly polarized wave. And both waves are strongly unstable. The linearly polarized is parametrically unstable, and the one that I like more is the circularly polarized. It is unstable to the wave overturn. So what happens is the following. In the MHD outflow, the phase speed of the MHD outflow may be thought of as the flow of the speed, the speed of the flow, sorry, which is less than the speed of light. Now, when the outflow turns into electromagnetic wave, the speed of electromagnetic waves is faster than the speed of light. So the wave starts to flow through plasma. And as the wave goes through plasma, it accelerates particle due to the Pandoramodic force. And this acceleration turns out to be unstable. The wave breaks. And it breaks at the time when the parallel velocity becomes equal to the group velocity of the flow. So the wave tumbles over. And, it is similar to optical shocks, what people see in the laboratory. And here is an example of an optical shock. So what they see, they shoot a very short optical pulse into an optically active medium. So that's the initial form of the pulse, a very nice Gaussian. But if the pulse is very strong, it develops a very sharp discontinuity. And the stronger the pulse, the sharper is the discontinuity here. And there they don't have plasma, so they don't have dissipation. But in a plasma, if you have very large gradients, you expect that there will be a lot of dissipation happening. And here is a hand-waving argument, but I think it's quite reasonable, that when the wave breaks, you will generate something like strong electromagnetic turbulence. By that, I mean that you have fluctuating electric and magnetic fields of the same order, and they're not necessarily perpendicular to each other, some random electric and magnetic fields. And we don't really understand MHD turbulence, non-relativistic MHD turbulence. So then a question arises, what can you say about relativistic turbulence? And it turns out that if you ask a question, if you drop a particle into a random electric and magnetic field of the same order, what would be the typical frequency of emission, typical energy of emission? And it turns out that would be virtually independent on the details of the turbulence in some limit. And here is how. So you have a random electric and magnetic fields. There will be acceleration by E parallel to V. Then there will be radiation due to the E perpendicular and B perpendicular. Radiation due to the E parallel is gamma squared times smaller. So the particle will emit something like a synchrotron emission in something like effective cyclotron frequency.
You mean emission of a test particle?
Test particle.
And other collective effects then?
Well, there should be, because it's a turbulence, but let's... I don't know.
It may depend on what is the wavelength. So.
Let's concentrate now for a test particle.
E parallel is huge compared to B perp. E parallel is huge compared to B perp.
Of the same order. Random fields, just.
But if you, I don't see how you can accelerate to big gamma.
So the energy of the particle will be radiation limited. You will be doing acceleration by E perp, and radiation due to the E perp and B perp.
But if E parallel is not bigger than B perp, aren't you going to have problems? How will you even get up to?
Of the same order.
They're of the same order.
Of the same order. E, all E's are of the same order as B's.
Are you appealing to E parallel to accelerate the particles to begin with? Or are they already at large gammas?
Doesn't really matter. It will be radiation limited. So we'll be looking for something like a stationary case. And the fields are so, you have B 10 to the 6, so E will be also 10 to the 6, so it's a big one. So,
if B perp and E parallel are the same order, then if you look at your MHD equations.
Yeah, it's not MHD. No. It's not MHD. It's some strong electromagnetic turbulence. I don't know what it is, but the logical events that led to this assumption, that the model. So.
But it had to come from MHD. I mean, the turbulence had to come from.
Well. It occurs at a region where MHD is not certified for periods of the order of, or for the wavelengths of the order of 10 to the 6 centimeters. When you break such a wave, you generate much smaller wavelengths. For them, MHD will not be satisfied even stronger.
I think what Mal is asking is, if E and B are the same, you write down an energy equation. There's a rate at which you put energy into the particle to be parallel.
Yes.
There's a rate at which it loses energy from synchrotron emission.
That's right.
That sets gamma.
That's right.
So what's the number?
That's right. That's we're getting there. So the emission will be something like synchrotron, but now the perpendicular electric field will also be doing the acceleration.
Is this what people used to call synchro Compton?
Synchrotron is a little bit different. And we may imagine two generic cases when the correlation length of the field fluctuations is larger than the radiative length where you emit half, you lose half of the energy, or the reverse case. So in the first case, the acceleration will be done almost by the constant electric field. And I call it maximally efficient. And surprisingly, so here is the answer. So we have radiative losses similar to the synchrotron formula. We have acceleration. So now, then equating this to, you get a gamma factor, and which is quite interesting. The typical energy is just a Compton energy, regardless of the details of the density, turbulence, and things like that. Which is a little bit large, but first, this was for maximally efficient acceleration. And the fact that it's large, but not larger than what I need is,
more comforting. What B field did you use to get 7 by 10 to the
4? It's independent.
It's independent.
Sorry, how did
B field is dependent. B field is dependent.
Right. Gamma depends on
10 to the 6.
Gamma does, but the mean energy of the photons does not.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Gamma does,
the mean energy does not.
Max, how did H bar come into this calculation?
Well, because the energy of the wave is H bar times frequency.
Right.
So, you can try to, decrease that energy. So if you have a small-scale field, how small? Well, you have a good typical length of the turbulence. It's just like a skin depth with a C over omega P. So then acceleration will be smaller by some to like the square root of the ratio to the radiative lens. And it turns out that this f is indeed small, and it's also very weakly dependent on our parameters. Okay. So then, yes?
Yeah. To get into this regime of acceleration, the low particle number density, but you're talking about energies now that are large enough to make positrons and electrons. So is it going to be consistent to have such a, you know, vacuum?
The optical depth should be small there because of the falling. The optical depth to gamma should be small there because of the following argument. Well, you had at large radii, so you've all your fluxes are down by. Well,
10 to the 12 centimeters is a typical optical.
You know, if you think in terms of the, you know, the compactness parameter, now this R is very large, so your compactness parameter is not. It's not very large, so you may worry about Compton effects, but they turn out to be not important there, at least in the first order. I guess the next step would be to model the spectra, but. To model the spectra, you need to model to understand well how your injection conditions and for the accelerations, and so I haven't done the modeling of the spectrum, but okay. And the next step is a little bit more of a hand waving that is work in progress. So you have this, even more hand-waving. You have this magnetized outflows, which carry a lot of magnetic field with them. So, and on that head, you know that there is, the afterglows are well modeled by the synchrotron emission in a plasma where in a magnetic field is of the order of the equipartition. And it seems interesting to try to produce afterglows due to the interaction of the interstellar medium with the moving magnetic barrier. And there, the equipartition will be given to you right away because the magnetic barrier will be, in the frame of the barrier, you would have the energy flux from the interstellar medium particles of the order of the magnetic field energy. So the way I picture it is something similar to the Earth's magnetopause. When you have an interstellar medium and you have a ejector, there is a contact discontinuity, a shock front, a bow shock up front, but this, since there is very little magnetic field in the interstellar medium, this bow shock may not be strongly radiative. But by the time it gets to the contact discontinuity, like on a day side of the Earth's magnetosphere, you would have reconnection. And this reconnection will put the very energetic interstellar medium particles onto the strong magnetic fields of the ejector. And by the way, the bow shock may not even exist for quite a long time because you will be reflecting particles from the barrier, and the reflected particles have energy of gamma squared. So their gyro radii of the ion gyro radii will be something like 10 to the 17 centimeters for gamma 10 to the 2. Meaning that it will be larger than the size of your cavity. So there may not be a bow shock up front for quite a long time. I guess I'm done.
is it possible that what we see in the crowd is the breaking of this way?
Yeah, it's the big question is how that this all corresponds to the crab. There is no good answer to that. First, so in crab we have this cavity inside 10 to the 17 centimeters which doesn't emit almost at all. So you may argue that the something like this happens, but the radiation is beamed out of your sight. But then you may argue that in crab the situation is stationary. So, and that may change the physics here. That may change the transition between MHD and the wave solution. And I guess Andrew would say that the waves may be stable.
No, Andrew would say that in fact you can't have more than 80% on, well, there are two things. You can't have more than 80% of the spin down luminosity being lost in some radiation like this, because 20% of the spin down luminosity is then reprocessed in the baryon, and you see that. So at least 20% of the spin down luminosity is going into the baryon. That's number one. The second thing is that, like you said, there's no emission from, almost no emission from the wind in the crab. And even with beaming, you would expect that if there was a strong, well, it's not clear what you would expect, but one possibility is that if there's an instability or breaking or whatever within the wind, then at least at the first point where that happens, there'll be enough randomization in the flow that you will see something. And you really don't see anything at all to very good limits, except for these knots, the things which has to be seen and which you know about well. So, I don't know, I mean, it's clear that you can't be losing more than, definitely you're not losing more than 8% of the spin down luminosity in this kind of
thing. But if your energy actually that you have is 2 tenths into the 50 is rather substantially less than the total, so obviously you can make it non-isotropic, but can you really make such a small beaming?
Of course you can crank a little bit magnetic field on. You can get dipole field 10 to the 16 easily, and I was assuming 3 to the 10 to the 15. Then in crab we see the jet with the opening angle something like 10%, so that gives you 100% in luminosity.
Yeah,
100 times in luminosity.
But then you're still only at 2 times 10 to the 52, and this very high redshift one was over 10 to the 53 isotropic.
Well, the, you know, yeah, magnetic scale squared with magnetic field then, so.
It's fine, I guess. We see magnetized 10 to the 16 Gauss fields, I would claim, so.
Yes.
Max, why is the linearly polarized mode not unstable to the
other term? It is. Linearly polarized mode is strongly unstable to parametric instabilities.
Parametric. Why not to
overturn? The overturn is a very slow process, so to say. So, circularly polarized wave in an electron-positron plasma, I think, may be stable. And it depends on the initial condition. If you just set up a circularly polarized wave that it existed everywhere, then it will be stable. So, but then I think that the proper case here would be that it is propagating, you know, it's coming into plasma, then it will be unstable. If you set up a linearly polarized wave in a plasma, it will break on its own on one period. It will strongly be strongly unstable in one period.
So you're saying it never gets to, like, it would be unstable to overturn, it's just that it doesn't matter.
It would be unstable to the, it would be more strongly unstable to the parametric instabilities on much shorter time scales.
You still have a problem with energetics, because in the crab there's actually most of the energy going to the jet. And this is
not most. could be part of
that. Okay.
Could you put the picture you had at the beginning of the gamma ray burst out?
The cartoon?
No, you had a nice
spiky
burst.
Nice spiky burst. Well,
I guess we don't really need it. My question is, how do we understand the quick rise and slow decay?
Yeah, the quick rise and slow decay. The quick rise is you damp the energy. When the wave overturns, you suddenly damp the energy into particles, you know, accelerate them in a very short time scale.
But what's that time scale?
Something like, you know, what's that time scale of the wave breaking? You know, it's a critical and boom. Something like the wave period. No. Okay, it's wave period, because the optical shocks they evolve slowly, and then they the final stage, the rise time of the shock is of the order of the wave period. So yeah, you dump the energy, and then it leaks as a synchrotron emission.
Perhaps a quarter or a third of bursts show behavior exactly opposite to that, like the time reversal of that. Slow rises and quick falls.
That's new to me.
And similarly, what happens in structure? You know, we have rise, decay, and then various subsequent events and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
The way I see it is like the breaking of the waves in the open ocean. So at any moment you see several, you know, this white foam, whereas now it's relativistically beamed foam. And so the one spike is one emission from one foaming region.
I guess overturn and spinning doesn't have to lead to turbulence necessarily, right? Because say if it's one dimensional sound waves, they just produce shocks, but the shocks are not turbulent.
Well,
so it overturns, but it steepens up and creates shock.
Yeah. Well, usually the shocks in the plasma, strong shocks in the plasma, are very turbulent.
You really answered the microstructure, but I'd just like take one of those pulses and then have another one 5 seconds later, 10 seconds later, and that's what we see in, you know, occasionally in bursts. It goes on. How do you explain that? So you have a dissipation, then another dissipation.
Yes.
It's a perennial problem for gamma ray burst models.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
We have time histories that go up, and the big spike, and then sort of a thread-like behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And then another one comes along. And then you might have three or four of them, stuff like that, that look like the discrete events superposed in time.
Well, the way I picture is...
foam is like the microstructure on top. We have lots of...
Well, the way I picture is overall is the general outflow, and then you have this microstructure inside, which is the breaking of these waves, producing you the
and it could be the central engine. Sometimes
right.
It's 100,000 seconds. So that's not what you're trying to explain.
No. Well, it could be the central engine also. So, and in some sense, observationally, these shocks will, these breaking regions will look very similar to the internal shocks, but with totally different microphysics.
Great. Well, it's like time to get.